Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, on February 9th, a train derailed outside East Palestine, Ohio. The toxic cargo purposefully ignited in a disastrously ill-advised attempt at environmental remediation has now sparked fears of what the effects of the chemicals released over the town will be for the people, livestock, and the ecology in and beyond East Palestine. Media covering the crash is poisoned too, as is now the common pattern, with differing political agendas piling on across social and legacy news platforms to leverage the story to their various advantage. David Rovick's frequent essays on political issues and societal observations are featured at Counterpunch and DissonantVoice.org, among other places. He's a broadcaster, musician, blogger, and author of the novel, A Busker's Adventures. His weekly program this week with David Rovick can be found through his website, davidrovick.com, and on Substack, where you can read his essays, listen to his hundreds of original songs, and catch his myriad interviews on topics of social relevance. His recent article, Communications for Indie Musicians, Then and Now, is a reflection not only on his quarter century making a living as a touring musician, but of living and working in our mediated times. His new album is Killing the Messenger, due out any day now. Welcome back to the program, David.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be back with you.
Well, it's always fantastic to speak with you. And now you've got a new song just out commemorating the event at East Palestine. And like so many of your songs, they are a chronicle of our times, especially American times. For the people that maybe don't know the background to the story, maybe they don't watch legacy news at all, which is an increasing number. What exactly happened on February 9th at East Palestine? Do we know the causes and so forth of this train derailment?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the folks who know about these things say that there's no question that if the modern braking system was in place, as was going to be required after the last major derailments, most notably in Canada, of course, at Lac-Mégantic, Quebec in 2013, when 48 people were killed by the oil train that went off the came off the bad braking, understaffed, et cetera. And there was another derailment in Washington State soon after that, which was pretty much an identical situation, except without the people. It happened in the middle of nowhere, so nobody got hurt in that. But, it could have been in the center of a town like it was in Quebec. There's these trains going through cities all over this country, including mine here in Portland. The braking systems that were supposed to be updated back at after 2013 were never updated because the rail lobbyists, the freight lobby, rail lobbyists lobbied Congress, both parties, and ultimately got the bill defeated, and it was never put out there. So basically, it just never happened. These changes never happened. And of course, the rail system itself, regardless of the brakes of the trains are using, the rail system is really old and dilapidated and, basically unfit for the kind of speeds, even though they're slow, that the freight trains are traveling at. And that's also part of why some of the derailments have happened, like in Washington State several years ago. This train in East Palestine was apparently traveling on track that was basically hadn't been updated much since the 1860s.
I'm ashamed to say I don't know what the Canadian situation is regarding the rail system here. I know that there's loads of derailments going on, that the infrastructure here is aged. I don't know if we've got the same corporate lobbying power in Canada as in the United States, where they can dictate policies and then cut corners to maximize their profits the way they do in the States. I was surprised to read how profitable the rail industry actually is. It's one of the most profitable investment industries in the United States because of their profit ratios, because they don't spend the money on upgrades and so forth, and they just take the crashes as the cost of doing business rather than the huge expense of upgrading their and maintaining properly the rail systems, which I know is fantastically expensive. When you mentioned Lac-Mégantic, that disaster in Quebec in 2013, the rail cars there, it was again with the brake systems, they'd parked, it didn't derail in the sense that this train did as it was moving forward, but it has actually parked and rolled backwards down into the town because the parking brakes didn't work, and they only had one guy on board when there should have been more, monitoring it. They weren't monitoring the quality of the brakes, and it rolled down the hill, and its cargo petrochemicals exploded in the heart of the town, killing, as you said, 48 people and blowing out the whole heart of this picturesque little Quebec town. But in this case, some video of the train that derailed in East Palestine, people had waiting at crossing in their cars were videoing the fire coming out of the wheels of this train as it passed by, and yet nothing happened to stop it before its eventual climactic catastrophe.
Yeah, I think in Canada they did make some kind of a change to the law after that disaster, and they increased the staffing minimum on, like, you can't have 72 cars with only one engineer in it. You have to have two now, I believe is what I recall.
Well, you know, in this country now, because of the pipelines being blocked or stopped or as a workaround, more and more of the tar sands oil and other noxious products are being transported by rail in this country. And some of these cars are miles long. You know, David, years ago when I was a young man, my brother and I jumped a freight train, you know, like in the Woody Guthrie tradition, and rode it into the woods of Northern Ontario, where it stopped in the middle of the night, in the middle of the summer. We were such noobs. We didn't realize what that meant, but we're soon almost devoured alive by mosquitoes and black flies. And so to take shelter from the boxcar to one of the engines, you know. And we had to run in the dark along the track for half a mile. And that was back in those days. I think the trains are even bigger now. Mm-hmm. How big was this train, do you know?
Let's see. Several dozen cars, 11 of which were full of toxic chemicals. I can't remember the number altogether, but apparently there are laws around, like, if you have fewer than 50 cars of toxic chemicals, then it doesn't need to be even mentioned to the local authorities that it's coming through. Right. If it's more than 50, then they have to mention some kind of crazy thing like that.
Yeah, well, you talk about it. Well, so now you wrote the song East Palestine. What? Tell me about it.
Well, I mean, honestly, there's just so many disasters going on all over the world all the time that I don't write about. And I think I should write something about that. But with this, it just came on me that when I was noodling around on the guitar, I came up with an idea for a song about it, really. But it's just describing what happened and describing how it was known that these things were going to happen, and this was an entirely preventable disaster that happened because of political corruption. That's the crux of it in terms of the song.
Yeah, the great cloud of toxic chemicals that was shown on television, which really brought this this whole disaster to. I mean, it might not have ever been known in the greater media sphere had it not been for this boneheaded decision to set alight all of these chemicals at once in this effort, as I mentioned in the intro, to as it was sold, to mitigate the disaster. But it seems that there was more behind that decision than as it was presented. Do you know any more about that, David?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's all sorts of there's a whole lot of bad things about burning it as opposed to letting it all go down into the ground. Lots of it went into the ground, but there's two creeks that passed through the town. Both of them were completely poisoned. Thousands of fish died. Other pets have died. People have been made sick, and definitely, but as far as I know, the burning of the tanks that were, but they didn't burn all the tanks of toxic chemicals. They only burned, as far as I read, two of them or something like that. And it was because of risk of explosion, because the temperatures were getting too high. So that's what I read anyway. But if they were also trying to cut corners and avoid cleanup, I wouldn't be at all surprised. I think they've gotten a lot of attention for this, including from the right-wing press, which is trying to paint the disaster as some kind of evidence of the government's lack of concern for white people. And so, you know, I think that now the federal government is getting more involved than they otherwise would have been because of all that right wing press coverage. And, you know, what unfortunately, I think you're not going to hear too much from either the liberal press or the right wing press is that, you know, our government is corrupt and doesn't care about the working class generally because the working class doesn't bribe them to do things like not impose regulation on the railways, you know. And this is harmful to everybody, especially anybody living near freight lines, which certainly includes a heck of a lot of white people as well as black people and brown people and native people and all kinds of people who are poor, which is where you tend to be when you, you know, people next to the freight yards are often not the folks in the mansions.
Well, of course, the other side of the tracks were just being, you know, in the nearer the proximity you are to the tracks, it's not a place where you want to be because of the noise and everything else. And and this whole idea of the media, you know, Pete Buttigieg is the transportation secretary in the Biden administration. He's been roasted for not going to the site immediately, as has Biden. And Donald Trump, you know, thinking of train wrecks, he was on the scene and using the occasion, as I mentioned in the intro, that people have been leveraging this story to their own advantage. And Trump was in there, but Trump had his chance to bring in legislation that would have made trains and freight trains safer on America's rails when he was president. But his administration didn't do anything either.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was the main failure to regulate the railways happened prior to his election, but certainly he never did anything about it during his 4 years in the White House. It's they're all trying to, Buttigieg is such a corrupt, is such a useless politician. He's completely in bed with industry. He's completely incapable of imposing regulation. I mean, he's becoming a laughing stock for that reason, even among the liberals, you know, who generally are not big fans of government regulation, lest they be accused of being socialists or something like that, you know. Buttigieg he just writes letters, you know. He calls the CEO of Southwest Airlines to complain instead of actually passing laws, which is what is supposed to be there to do as the transportation secretary. It's his job to regulate these industries, and he's not doing that.
Well, and like any citizen, he's sitting. I can see him now sitting at his kitchen table, writing an angry letter, a letter to the editor, or a letter to the CEO, Mr. So and So. But to say a politician is useless—that's sort of a redundancy in terms, isn't it? I mean, politicians don't want to do anything because anything they do is going to be unpopular with somebody, and especially now in America, and it's true in Canada too, but more obviously so in America, where the political divide is so evenly split, where you're sure to piss off 50% of the population no matter what you do.
I don't know. It depends on how it's spun and who. I think it's really all about political corruption at the end of the day, and not so much about polarization. You know, the polarization is superficial and not really not very real when you really get down to what people believe about most things. It's these hot button social issues that everybody's polarized around because of media manipulation, I think, primarily. But if you get down to what most people think government is supposed to be there for, and basic questions like that, there's widespread agreement in society, in this society, about what the role of government should be. It's just when you start introducing words that everybody's heard too much on certain media platforms, you know, that make them think of bad people, you know, bad socialists or bad fascists or whatever it is they've been trained to think is bad. You know, that's when they get all polarized politically. But if you avoid those words and you just talk about, well, should government be responsible for providing housing and health care for everybody? You know, most people say yes, believe it or not. In this country, most people, the vast majority, answer that question with a yes. And that's including Republicans. It's shocking, but it's true. And you can find that with loads of different questions. When you ask them in a neutral, sensible way, you find that we have a socialist majority in this country. They just don't know it.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me of not falling for the red blue dynamic. This magician's
It's a fake
ploy.
Divide.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with David Rovics. David is a frequent essayist and a frequent guest on this show, too, over the very many years we've been talking. I don't know what it is, David. I can't even remember now, 10 or 12 years anyway. David's the author of the novel A Busker's Adventures, a chronicle of his many adventures. He's been doing this for a quarter of a century now, living as a touring musician. His weekly program is This Week with David Rovics. You can go to David Rovics, that's with a CROVICS.com. And he's on Substack, and he's like just about everywhere else too that you can be. He's got hundreds and hundreds of original songs and many more. Your song map is I don't know of anyone else that does anything like that outside of maybe a library of some kind. We're talking around his recent article that is at counterpunch.org, among many other places, Communications for Indie Musicians Then and Now. We haven't really got to that yet in a big way, David. So let's talk a little bit about that now. This I pulled up a little thing here. Because I'm Canadian, anytime I hear about media, I think of Marshall McLuhan, of course. And in his book, Understanding Media, The Extensions of Man, from 1964, he writes, if you'll bear with me, quote, "The medium is the message. This is merely to say that the personal and social consequences of any medium, that is, of any extension of ourselves, results from the new scale that is introduced into our affairs by each extension of ourselves or by any new technology." When you're writing in your recent piece, David, Communications for Indie Musicians Then and Now, it really it reminded me of McLuhan, where we're in this milieu, this new technology that you're on both sides of. Your career began before the social media, as did my show, and now you've maneuvered into and through it, and you get a perspective because of your great age of being around before the technology, which gives you an advantage of those that it's always been there for. What's the push of your article? What's the thesis of Communications for Indie Musicians Then and Now? And am I just blowing it way out of proportion to drag Marshall?
Oh, no, you got it. You nailed it. And I love that quote. It's absolutely true. Yeah, totally. The medium is the message. The medium determines the message in such a massive way. And I've been at this for 30 years now. So it's just, in the article, I talk about the past 25 specifically because those are the years during which I have, and most people have had email and access to the internet, right? So of course we all know lots of geeks who were doing the internet as far back as the 80s or before then. The vast majority of society, including myself, didn't start using the internet in any, you know, significant way until like 1997 or so. And that was, it's basically been 25 years of the internet and 17 years of domination of the internet and of our communications by corporate social media platforms. Like it or not, that's the reality. And these different periods, pre-internet and post-internet, but pre-social media and post-social media, you know, have had massively different aspects to them in terms of how we communicate and how we understand the world and how we make a living. And for anybody like a journalist or a musician or an artist, you know, you use these kinds of means of communication as a sort of a freelance, you know, DIY or sole proprietor or whatever. You use these forms of communication to promote your work. I mean, that's the essential use of communication, other than just to be human and communicate with other humans, is to, it's part of your work. That's how you sell paintings or get gigs performing or sell your services as a journalist or whatever it is you're doing. So certainly for anybody remotely related to what we today call content creation, the internet has been massive and corporate social media has been massive, and it's been massive mostly in a negative way, overwhelmingly negative, in terms of, I basically break it down into the different uses of communication for artists specifically, and for musicians, traveling musicians specifically, myself, and you know, specifically, and what the different uses of the internet are for communicating with people, and how we did it before the internet, and how we have done it since the internet. And I just kind of break it down, and basically some things are about as good as they used to be, and with some things there was a temporary advantage of the internet being around that was killed off later by corporate social media, and with other aspects things have just clearly gotten worse, and specifically some of those ways are, well, one way that's very well known for anybody familiar with the whole streaming reality is making a living, which has been devastating. But there's so much more than that. And one of them that I start with is receiving insults, because this is a phenomenon that just didn't used to happen in any kind of significant way. That may be different for really famous musicians or movie stars or whatever. I'm sure there's ways that they probably got inundated with negative feedback from society when you are at a certain level of fame. But I think you have to be really famous before you get to that point where that kind of thing might even happen. Because certainly for me, I was pretty much, I'd say, as well known in the late 90s as I have been at any time since then for a variety of different reasons. And but still at no point before social media did I get deluged with daily insults about my intelligence or my music or who I have talked to on my YouTube channel or whatever it is people think they need to publicly denounce me for. You know, that just didn't used to happen. That's a
Right, that there was a time when I used to get insulting phone calls from some dedicated guy who didn't like me, and sometimes he'd call as often as daily. I mean, first of all, do you miss that guy? And secondly, has this one guy become is maybe he was the prototype for the modern communication system that followed?
Yeah, and who knows how many actual trolls are there on Reddit and Twitter, and how many of them are the same person?
It's that guy. It's that same guy.
It could be the same guy. I mean, you can tell that many of the accounts are the same person because of the way that they, either that or they're all listening to the same podcast or something, because they love to use exactly the same vocabulary, and they exhibit the same kinds of bizarre kind of macho behaviors, you know, coming from people that are supposed to be leftists, which is always a bit odd when they start with this macho, it's sexist stuff. And I think, well, who are these people, and who are they even pretending to be? I'm not even sure who, you know, if it's an agent pretending to be a leftist, they're getting it wrong, because the leftists are not supposed to make macho, sexist statements. That's not a leftist kind of thing to do generally. You know, so then I wonder, who are these people? I don't even know who they're pretending to be. But there's clearly they clearly want to pretend to be a lot of people. You know, they want to appear to be numerous, and the platforms make it extremely easy for them to do that. You know, I mean, these platforms, if they weren't designed by intelligence agencies who are bent on atomizing and society and destroying the left and you know, polarizing everybody into little camps and fiefdoms. If they weren't designed for that purpose, they should have been, because they're doing exactly that really effectively and very profitably at the same time.
Well, that leads to something that another piece you've written, and it's at Counterpunch, and I really want to talk about Robert Hoyt. David, now, this article that you wrote, Remembering Robert Hoyt, it's a really moving article you've written in memorializing him, plus an ancient photograph of, well, maybe ancient might be putting too fine a point on it, of yourself and Robert, and of course,
over 30 years old, I'd say, yeah.
Well, who was Robert? Who was Robert Hoyt then?
Robert Hoyt was born in Georgia in 1954, and he was the Robert Hoyt I knew was a brilliant singer-songwriter, guitarist, pianist, singer, and he, I would say, led a variety of lives, not in a two-faced kind of way, but just kind of had very distinct phases to his life, I would say. And I think most people that knew Robert knew the Robert of the 1990s, who spent the entirety of that decade on tour throughout the United States as a basically a troubadour for Earth First. Although, I mean, he was more than that. He was a, you know, three-dimensional person, but that's probably the political sort of identity that he would most strongly embrace. And he wrote a lot of great songs and put out three really kick-ass albums during that period of, like, between, I guess, 89 to 2001, basically, as the period of the height of his activity as a Earth First troubadour, basically as a singer-songwriter. And most of that time, he was living out of the back of a pickup truck, one of a few different pickup trucks he went through during massive amounts of traveling around the country in a pickup truck. And most of that time happened to coincide with being the human for a paraplegic cat named Claude, who was paralyzed from the waist down in a tragic accident sometime in, I believe, the late 80s. And then basically when Robert started traveling around performing, he was the caretaker for this paraplegic cat, which, if anybody out there has taken care of a paraplegic cat, then you know that this is a very active role that requires your presence on a, you know, pretty much every few hours at the very least to help this cat with their needs. And so that Claude in many ways sort of defined Robert's existence, and also a wonderful guy made a really nice documentary about Robert's travels with his cat called Travels with Claude, which really does a great job of capturing a few days in the life of Robert's existence, at least part of a Midwest tour, basically. And,
yeah. Well, you write about going on tour with him yourself, and how formative that was for you, and for no other reason, for all of the connections that you made that carried you through the rest of your career, and people that you still know communicate with now, all these years later.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just being a friend of Robert's before we started touring together, I met so many wonderful folks just through kind of bumming around with him and meeting up with him in different places. And one of the things about being friends with a touring musician long before I was a touring musician myself was you get to see them wherever it is that you, if you're an itinerant type, like young person like I was and so many others are, I was living in different places, and you'd always see Robert because he was traveling. So, you know, I'd always see him, whether it was Boston or Seattle or whatever. Is that for a lot of folks. But then when he always kind of had it, put it out there, knowing that I had a past as a bass player, he always put it out there that if I ever wanted to travel with him and play bass and sing harmonies, that I should just say the word. And I don't know why it took me so long to agree to do that with him, but I did. And then that was definitely the most, when I started doing that with him, and coincided with when I also started writing a lot more songs and was thinking about doing that kind of songwriting touring thing. And he kickstarted that in a brilliant way, better than anything. I mean, I always tell other folks who are looking to start touring and playing original songs and stuff that the best possible way to do that is to hook up with somebody else who's doing the same kind of thing you want to do, and supporting them as an opening act or singing with them or whatever. But definitely I was opening for him at all these gigs, and that was the key thing that got me lots of gigs afterwards. I don't think it would have worked that way if I was just playing bass and singing harmonies with him. But the fact that he was having me open for him was really like each gig was like an audition, and I was passing, you know, at each gig, you know, because the folks who had hired him to perform were obviously in the audience, you know, at each of the gigs. So, you know, and this was also back at a time when you were getting hired to perform. I mean, this is for a lot of musicians today, that's a foreign concept. You know, you organize a gig, you rent the venue, and you hope you get a crowd that's big enough that you might do better than break even. That's the reality for so many DIY musicians today in the U.S. The way it was back then was there were gigs like that, but then there were also lots of gigs where you'd play on a college campus for a progressive college group of students who had a budget in